Okay, thank you for the invitation to come and talk. It's always fun to be back here. So this is some work that is almost completed, and I'll show you some of the results, and there's some more that will be forthcoming, and we're writing this up with Supreet Singh, who's a postdoc at UNB with me. So what I'll do is first start off with some general quantum gravity questions, which probably most of you know about already, but it's worth staring at them. It's smaller than I thought. Can everybody read that? All right, that's better. So after the QG questions, I'll talk a little bit about some simple models and see what happens in them. And then the main thing will be this model of cosmology with matter. And it's a small model, but still, I think it sets the stage for some bigger calculations, which will be in the next steps. Okay. So a few comments. So far as I put non-string there, but there are no string theorists, so I could have removed that. So far, most work in canonical QG or spin foams is mainly about gravity and geometry, and there's almost no work on matter. I know that people are working on this. And this is a big gap. If you look at spin foam CDT LQG, there are practically no calculations that involve matter of any kind. The formalism is set up in many cases, but there are almost no calculations of any kind. So when we do have matter, then you can view the Hilbert space of the system as a tensor product of geometry variables and matter variables. That's the normal expectation if you're going to set up a canonical quantization. And so if you do set this up, then in some way, then one of the things you want to calculate is what sort of entanglement is there in natural physical states, and how does that entanglement evolve? And of course, by entanglement entropy, I just mean von Neumann entanglement entropy, where you have some states, and then you evolve states and keep checking to see what's happening to this entanglement. So that's sort of the idea that I'm...
Can you say more about the tensor product?
Yes, I'm going to... Sorry? Oh, I see. So from the canonical perspective, if you start off with a phase space that has gravity degrees of freedom and matter degrees of freedom, then you would start off by saying, okay, if you want to convert matter variables and geometry variables into operators, what's the choice of Hilbert space are you going to make? Because the Hilbert space here is viewed as a vessel. And so if I'm just doing pure gravity, there'll be Hilbert space for just the gravity variables. If you're doing pure gravity, if you're doing just matter on a fixed background, there'll be Hilbert space for the matter degrees of freedom and matter observables for quantum field theory on a fixed background. So if you have both, then you want to have a bigger Hilbert space, so the natural choice is that you would begin, if you like, that's part of the proposal, you would begin with a tensor product Hilbert space of some kind. And I'll tell you what that is in the model that I'm going to talk about. It's also, yeah, I'm going to come to that on the next slice, whether it's kinematical or dynamical in a second. So it's really, if you like, it's a starting point. And if you're going to have both variables, you need to have a Hilbert space that'll carry all the operators. Okay. Okay, so here's the big questions. What is the physical Hilbert space? Are the solutions, if you're trying to solve the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, are the solutions of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation such that matter states and geometry states are always entangled in physical states? With respect to some time variable, if you make a time choice, either relational or through gauge, you want to ask the question, if you can evolve, how does the entanglement entropy evolve in this setting? And more importantly, one of the motivations here is when we have derivations of quantum field theory on Kerr space-time from the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, there are lots of heuristic derivations in the literature, and they typically say, here's the Wheeler-DeWitt equation for gravity coupled to matter, and in order to extract something like a QFT on a background, you start off with a product state, where by Q I mean geometry and by phi I mean matter, and typically the product state is of this type, where you say that the gravity state is a function of Q, and it depends on some parameters, Q0, and the Q0 are peaking parameters for some sort of a Gaussian state that says, okay, I have this state for gravity, which is peaked on the geometry Q0, and it has some spread. Then the matter state, phi represents matter, and the phi, the phi state will just be one which depends on the peaking parameters of the state of this state here. So one of the important questions about this is, does it actually happen? Can product states arise dynamically from quantum gravity in some mechanism? So what I'm going to do here is tell you, give you some simple examples which have nothing to do with gravity, and then come to a gravity model. And I'll make a time choice. I'll actually do some real live evolution. In fact, I have some movies here, but I can actually also run the program with any initial data you choose to give me, so I'll have a live movie generation. But the question is this: can product states arise dynamically from QG? And if not, then how do we deal with this kind of situation? Yes?
Are you going to use some kind of coherent states for gravity?
I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do. Yeah, so the whole idea would be, so the setup I'm going to describe is there'll be a state, which could be an entangled state. It need not be a coherent state. And then I'll describe an evolution of that state with respect to a time variable. So that's what I'm building to.
So by peaking, what do you mean?
So by peaking, I do mean some sort of a Gaussian state or some sort of coherent state. That's what I mean by peaking. Sorry, that's what you're asking. Yeah.
So Q0 is a classical data from which?
So this would be some class, Q0 would be some classical data that you pick, and you make a coherent state peaked on that classical data. And then this other state is basically takes that classical data as your background space time, or background space if you're looking at the canonical situation. And you want to construct solutions of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation of this type. Okay. So that's not actually what I'm going to do. This is just a motivation. And the motivation mainly is, can you actually get states like this arising from a model of quantum gravity or not? Okay, any other questions? All right, so I already mentioned this. So what we did is we actually studied the evolution of entangled entropy dynamically in two little models. And then the main thing is the scalar field scalar cosmology with a dust clock, see what happens. The reason I do these two simple models is that some of the results are interesting, even though the models are really simple. And it's sort of worth seeing what happens in systems that you can exactly solve. Okay, so the first model is the simplest you can imagine. It's two spin systems, so the Hilbert space is spin a half, tensor spin a half. And the Hamiltonian is just basically first system, sigma z, second system, sigma z, then an interaction, which is sigma plus, sigma minus, sigma minus, sigma plus. Now, this is simple enough that you can solve everything. And in particular, one of the solutions to the time-dependent Schrodinger equation looks like this. There are lots of others, but I picked that one because it gives a very interesting result. So really, really simple model, elementary thing. It can be generalized to higher spins, if you like, and there are similar results. So what you find is, if you calculate the entanglement entropy, what happens is that it sort of oscillates like that. It goes from product to fully entangled, to product to fully entangled, to product to fully entangled. So it just cycles through. And of course, this is for some choice of coupling G that I drew that graph. And it's sort of curious that, this line is not curious. The green line just says maximum entropy of the system is going to be log 2. That's where that line is at log 2. And this is sort of a typical kind of behavior, and it's the kind of thing you might want stretched out in a big model of quantum gravity, because what you might want is, okay, you start off at the Big Bang, which is highly entangled, the universe expands, and entanglement goes to zero, provided the time is stretched out. And then you have some region down there where QFT on curve space-time is emerging, then it's going away again because you have a big crunch and so on. The problem is that's not what we're going to see. And this is really an extremely elementary, simple model where this is exact behavior. So let me give you another example, a simple model which is more complicated and it's not all analytic. And that's the spin oscillator model. This has been around for many years, since the 1960s. It's used in quantum optics. So I thought it was an interesting thing to try to see what happens here. So the model is really simple. You've got the oscillator coupled to a spin, and the interaction is exactly of the kind you might imagine if you want to cook up a simple model of a spin interacting with an oscillator. You have the diagonal term, which is the number operator. You have the diagonal term for the spin, which is just sigma z in this case. And then you have the interaction. So now here, you can start off. So to do a calculation, of course, you take the oscillator part and you truncate the Hamiltonian. It's some n by n tensor 2 by 2. And you can start with all kinds of states. This particular demonstration is for starting with a Gaussian for the oscillator and the down state for the spin. And we did two different spins just to see what happens. So spin one is the blue, and spin half is the red. And you can see that this is a product state. So it starts off, entanglement entropy starts off zero. It starts oscillating, and it never really comes back down to anything remotely unentangled. And it keeps hitting the top. This is log 3. This is log 2, because the entanglement entropy is determined by the smaller system, and it doesn't matter what you trace out. So these are the two limits. So the important point to take away is there's absolutely no recurrence of product states even in a tiny system like this. I mean, it's pretty tiny. It's a little bigger than the last system, but it's very tiny. And similar results happen if you go to higher spin, and you have the entanglement entropy starts goes up, hits the top, starts oscillating near the top, near the log of 2s plus 1. Yes?
What's being traced out here?
Sorry?
What's being traced out?
You can trace out the oscillator or the spin. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter, yeah. The entanglement entropy peaks at the dimensionality of the smaller Hilbert space. Okay. So that's why this top line is log 3, this is log 2. And if you do any arbitrary spin s, you see that it's caps off at log 2s plus 1. Okay. So there are occasional dips that occur, especially in the spin half thing, so still it's not completely unentangled. But the general point is, if you start off with any kind of, and you can start these things off in highly entangled states too, and then it just stays near the top, keeps hitting the wall at the top. It never comes down. It sort of dips down occasionally, but really never near zero entanglement entropy. Okay. Okay, so those are the two really simple models, and now we come to the main model, and that's cosmology with the scalar field and dust. Yes?
Yep. It's true that most states are close to maximally entangled if you just take a random.
Yes, yes, that's right. So that's right.
You'd expect this to happen.
Yes, yes, not surprising. What was surprising is the first one where it keeps oscillating because it's so small.
But also you picked a sort of special initial condition.
Actually this is a particularly teasing state which does give this kind of behavior where it doesn't stick near the top. But I think if you can try a few other states in this simple model, and you get pretty close to zero a lot of the time, partly because the model is so small. Okay, so coming to cosmology with scalar and dust, so here what I want to do is extract a cosmological model out of this action. So the action is just Einstein gravity here, scalar field here, and this thing in the middle, which is the action of a pressureless dust. And here, M is a function, and P is the dust field. And this is basically the function M imposes the condition that the dust whirl lines are time-like. So since I want to do canonical gravity, you can take this and write the canonical version of this action using standard ADM decomposition. And you get the usual thing. You get the gravity part, the ADM variables. You get the symplectic structure for the dust. You get the symplectic structure for the scalar field and whatever else you want to put in. And then you have the constraints. And I wrote out the constraints for just the explicitly just to tell you, show you what they look like, especially for the dust case. It looks rather odd like that. And it's because of this form that you get the special physical Hamiltonian that I'm going to talk about. Okay. So everything is more or less standard except for this thing. And then you have the diffeomorphism constraint, which has exactly the form that you expect. Okay, so now what happens to this system is that it simplifies very nicely if you use the dust time gauge. So pick the gauge and solve the constraint and solve the Hamiltonian constraint. Then what happens is that this time gauged action looks like this. The dust field is gone. You have the symplectic structure left for the scalar field for gravity. You have a physical Hamiltonian, and you still have the Diffeo constraint.
So, what is
yes.
M capital
M? It's a function. It's just a field. It turns out to be related to the dust energy density. So if you work out...
Can you specify it? Or?
Right now, it's just a free function. They're all free functions, yeah. So the action is a functional of all of these fields.
So you vary M?
You vary M, absolutely. You vary M to get the condition that the dust field is time-like. And what has happened here is that you get the equation of motion for M, you get the equation of motion for T, and you can solve the equations of motion. There's a couple of steps I missed in this. You solve the equation of motion for M and plug it back in. So this is basically involves a little bit of reduction to get to here. So the takeaway message really is that this Hamiltonian is really simple. It is exactly what used to be the Hamiltonian constraint, and now it's eaten up because I put too much on a slide. The physical Hamiltonian is just this part plus this part, and it's non-vanishing. Okay, so this sort of, if you like, looks like Young-Mills theory, except instead of the Gauss law, you have the diffeomorphism constraint, and instead of the Young-Mills Hamiltonian, you have a slightly more complicated Hamiltonian. And there's still 2 degrees of freedom. So I should say it's cut off at the bottom, is that this action is a special case of one used by Brown and Kukash. They had 4 dust fields. And what Thomas Pawlowski and I did is we just got rid of 3 of them because we didn't want to fix the diffeos. We wanted to ask what could be done with loop quantum gravity, where we know how to handle the spatial diffeomorphism constraint, but we don't know how to handle the Hamiltonian constraint. So if you apply this kind of thing to LQG, this is a side comment, then physical Hamiltonian here is exactly what used to be the Hamiltonian constraint. Okay. And so what happens for LQG is instantly the kinematical Hilbert space becomes the physical Hilbert space by this device. And then you can go ahead and calculate whatever you want to calculate in principle. Anyway, so this is the setup, and now in the next slide, I'm going to reduce this to cosmology. Okay? Questions at this point? Is that readable? Shall I make this big? Okay. So if you reduce to cosmology, what you do with the metric part is it's just the scale factor, homogeneous isotropic cosmology. Scale factor is conjugate momentum, the scalar field and its conjugate momentum. And the physical Hamiltonian looks like that. It's very simple, and you've probably seen it in other forms. If you didn't have the dust time gauge, this would still be a Hamiltonian constraint, but it's not here. It's the true physical Hamiltonian. And then you can make a nice canonical transformation to convert this into this, and this. We do this mainly for the evolution code that I'm going to develop and talk about. We develop and talk I'll talk about in a minute. If you have any other functions here, like if I use this, the code is sort of very hard to implement. So this after this canonical transformation, it becomes easier. Yes, sir.
So the dust time is that the same as proper time along the dust world?
That's right. It is. Yeah, so
I think in a way, all you're doing is holding fixed the, doing the variational principle, holding fixed the proper time.
You can view it that way, but you don't need to view it that way. Yeah, you can view everything as dynamical.
It's equivalent.
So
that makes it. I know if you do that, you get a fictitious dust. Well, I call it fictitious dust appearing. I guess that's what you've done.
So here I started with the dust, and I basically said I've got more degrees of freedom. I've got the full ADM canonical action with the 3 sets of degrees of freedom. Then I do some gauge fixing, and it has this nice canonical structure.
Right, but I'm guessing that there's an equivalent way of describing it.
Probably at the covariant level, there's an equivalent way of describing it. But here I want to do quantization from the ADM perspective, so that's why I'm fixing the gauge and extracting the physical Hamiltonian, then I want to work with the physical Hamiltonian.
Yeah, I think I'm saying almost the same. Fixing
okay.
The gauge as a proper time gauge.
Yes.
And That it's the proper time gauge fixing is one way.
It is. From the canonical point of view, it kills a degree of freedom. And the Hamiltonian constraint becomes second class, so you solve it exactly. So you end up with this Hamiltonian structure. Okay, so basically what you end up with then is you can quantize this. How would you quantize this? You have the Hilbert space for the scale factor. You have the Hilbert space for the scalar field. You take the tensor product, and then you want to do the standard quantization, physical Hamiltonian. You get this time-dependent Schrodinger equation. Now, this looks pretty simple, except that it's kind of tough to solve even numerically, mainly because of this 1 over x squared sitting here. Without this, it would be like just a simple diffusion problem. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the numerical technique I used, and maybe I should have called up Luis earlier and saved a lot of time in solving this. But okay, so what I'm going to do next is basically solve this for various initial data just to see what happens. Okay. Yes?
So before doing the time-dependent problem, you might ask about the time-independent problem. And here you have this minus p squared that looks like it might be a problem. Like, is this have a... Did you look at the spectrum sort of prior to
No. Didn't look at the spectrum. Didn't even think about looking at the spectrum because... It would involve basically truncating, getting an n by n matrix, and then trying to diagonalize that matrix. So it's very hard to do anything analytically with that Hamiltonian. At least I couldn't find a way to think about that analytically. I mean, you can always diagonalize numerically and get some idea, but it's not really revealing. Yeah. Okay, so you want to solve this numerically. So I want to tell you a little bit about, after banging our heads against a wall, we found a technique. And so the numerical scheme is basically a modification of something called the alternating direction implicit method for two-dimensional diffusion. It's a modification because we have that 1 over x squared. Let me just go back to this for a second. What's going on here is that this is normal or diffusion with an I. This is diffusion in the phi direction, except that as the universe expands, this diffusion constant starts going to zero, because x gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
But you have a sign difference also.
And you also have a sign difference on top of it. Yes, 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 that's right. So it's different from diffusion in a number of ways. There's a sign difference, there's of course an I, and then there's a 1 over x squared. Okay, so basically it means you have to stay away from x equals 0 in implementing this. Nevertheless, it can be done. And so this is sort of the method. It's not that complicated once you get used to it, and initially it looked like, oh, can I even code this up? So essentially what you do is you discretize, you convert the continuum into a matrix. It's labeled by n, which is time, and ij. I represents phi, j represent x, or the other way around. So you convert the wave function to a matrix. And then the essence of this method is that it uses the so-called Crank-Nicholson method twice with an alternating step, and that's sort of this method here. It's a pretty old method. So what happens in this method is, suppose you have a time step, you want to evolve data from one time step to another time step, which is delta t away. This is a little bit of a dry thing, but it's just simple enough that I think it's easy to explain how to do this, so you can all go code this up yourselves. You want to go from time step n to time step n plus 1, but you want to go through an intermediate step n star in the middle. So you have the time step, you break it up into two parts, and you calculate an intermediate value of this wave function u star by using this formula, and then you go to the next step by using this intermediate one you calculated using this method. So the idea is that this step is implicit in x direction because it's got u star here, so you have to invert a matrix. That's the essence of Crank-Nicholson. And over here, this is implicit in phi, because you have u n plus 1 here and n plus 1 here, so you have to invert a matrix to get to the next step. The advantage of doing this is that this scheme is unconditionally stable, and one of the important things we want to check when we want to do an evolution is if probability is conserved. So it turns out, if you do runs and do all kinds of checks, that even for fairly large time steps and fairly large space and phi steps, you get probability conservation to 10 to the minus 6 or so. So it's a really good method.
to figure all these methods that are implicit and therefore conditionally stable, they do away with murder because any physics that happen at scales shorter than the time scales you're using are completely ignored. So are you sure that those the physics that will be smaller than delta t, whatever delta t.
Yes, so I'm going to show you that the time steps I'm using are larger than this delta t.
Are larger.
So this is the time step of evolution, and so when I do evolve for larger time steps, there are multiple, are you worried about the spatial grid or the time grid?
I'm thinking, suppose you have an oscillator that oscillates at kilohertz.
Yeah.
And yet I'm taking steps that are larger than a second. So I could make a scheme that is stable, but the physics at a kilohertz range, I wouldn't see at all.
Yeah, so here there are no natural oscillations of that type. I know the point you're making. There are no oscillations of that type here. There's just a damped diffusion constant, right? So there's no other potential. I think that might be something we need to face if we add a potential for the scalar field. Then it might be something we need to worry about. Okay, so what happens is we looked at product states and we looked at some entangled states. So here is a typical evolution starting from a product state. It's a Gaussian, this should be phi. It's a Gaussian in x. X is the scale factor variable, really, and y is the scalar field variable. And we want to give the scale factor variable some velocity initially, so there's a p0 here. So what we are seeing generically is states like this evolve to squeeze states, and they're pretty, it happens very rapidly. And this is a comment I already made. Spreading in phi slows as the universe expands due to the 1 over x squared, and spreading in the scale factor direction just continues because it's 1, whereas the spreading in the scalar field direction just goes to 0. And so that's going to be apparent. So before I show you the movie, I just want to show you what a typical increase looks like for, this is entropy, entanglement entropy, and this is for momentum 2.5. It's not a large momentum. Typically, you want a much bigger momentum, but I can't do that on the laptop because it runs off the grid very quickly, and it's already taking a few minutes to run on the laptop. So you can see the entanglement entropy just straight increasing. It starts off with a curve, then becomes linear. This is for that. This is another one for momentum 1. You can see stays 0 for a long time. Notice that these numbers are pretty small here for the entanglement entropy, so we haven't really explored a lot. These are a bit larger. So when the velocity, initial velocity is large, the entanglement entropy increases much more rapidly than when the initial velocity is small. And that's not surprising because I'll show you a movie in which you can see that happening. Yes?
What's the scale factor to it? Is it like a matter? Dominated?
No, it's fully coupled. You can't say it's matter dominated at all, from at least from the length of evolution that I've done.
But if you look at the, like, did you look at the behavior, like, say, expectation value of A or something?
So we didn't look at that directly. We looked at it in the model systems, but not in this system, partly because we weren't really able to get to large times. So it would have been sort of almost a flat line with slight increase. So you can sort of see that, eyeball it from the movies that I'm going to show you. I agree, that's one of the things that we need to compute, but we need a sort of a bigger computer to do those things with. Okay, so now, if you start off with states of this kind, which are highly entangled, as opposed to the product states, this is one over width, and this is a minus sign, and this is a plus sign, this is a really squeezed state, then we also see similar behavior. You start off with a high entropy this time because this initial state is high entropy. It doesn't decline, it just keeps rising. Okay, so let me just now pull up a couple of the movies that I have here, show you what they look like. So here, before I hit play, this vertical axis is the scalar field, minus 10 to 10, and this is the scale factor increasing in this direction. So what you see is, again, it's not going for very long. It's going to get near the end of the grid. And so this is what happens. So you can see what's happening is that the spread in the scale factor direction just stretches out, and the spread in the phi direction gets smaller and smaller as time evolves because of the 1 over x squared in the kinetic term. So this is sort of not surprising, because you can sort of imagine this happening just by staring at the Hamiltonian constraint, because you've got the momentum term divided by root q. And if you have inhomogeneities, well, I don't know how to code up beyond this model yet. But that's the kind of thing that's happening. So one more movie, which is a bit longer time on a bigger grid, and you can see the same thing happening there, okay, this is sort of flipped over because you have the scale factor going vertically this time and the scalar field horizontally. And it's pretty much the same behavior. You start with a nice Gaussian state in both a scale factor and the scalar field, and kind of a jerky movie because we didn't take snapshots at many more regular time steps. So again, the same thing happens. Squeezes very rapidly, and the entanglement entropy just shoots up very rapidly.
Are these Planck units, or are they?
Everything is, I should have said that. Everything is Planck units. So everything is scaled, so the units are all dimensionless. Every variable is dimensionless, scaled out by the Planck factor. Yeah. So those are two of them. I just want to show you one other, which is starting with a squeeze state. I can't find it right now, but I'll just show it after the talk. So, so the main lesson from all of these things is that if you have a full quantum gravity model, even though this is a small model, there's a time, there's some matter, and there's some geometry, you start off with some initial state and evolve, you find that the entanglement entropy just increases between matter and geometry as the universe expands. And this has occurred in every, so again, I should, a small caveat, we haven't been able to evolve for very long, mainly because we need a big computer to do that. But I don't see this going away, even from the little toy models, the oscillator and the spin. It never comes back down for that. There's no reason it's going to come back down for this, if I could evolve for much longer times on a much bigger grid. So that's the kind of generic behavior, at least in this model, with this time variable. So let me talk a little bit about next steps, and I'll show you this other movie, which I couldn't locate. So this is, again, basically a quantum mechanics model that's coming from GR with dust and a scalar field. So what we want to do is gather more evidence and longer evolution times if you want to continue with this model. More important than that is to talk about larger models with local degrees of freedom. That's much more complicated. You don't want to sort of go into cosmology with perturbation theory, because that's not the point of this exercise. The point of the exercise is, if you want to do things like this, you don't do a breakup of some background plus some perturbations and then try to code up something. You want to start with the whole thing and then see how you can evolve, at least for small times. And some, it may require truncation, it may require large n by n matrices that you diagonalize and construct an evolution operator and proceed. So, but certainly larger models are what you need. The other thing that needs to be checked is, suppose you make other time choices, is there a way to do this in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation directly without fixing a time gauge in any formalism, in any way? That would be very interesting. And then the important question is, if this is really right, sort of very standard thing that I'm doing, it's just a calculation, If it's really true that there's matter entanglement entropy and this entanglement entropy increases as the universe expands, then right now geometry and matter are all entangled at this state. And so what are the physical consequences? What does that mean? And I don't know what that means. Okay. But certainly the evidence so far is that we are not going to get a product state, which raises this question of how do you get QFT and curved space-time from quantum gravity if the input is to be a product state? The product state should evolve naturally. It's not evolving naturally. Okay. So that's my talk. And let me just show you that other movie. And then we'll open it up to questions. Wow, I finished pretty early. Okay. Okay, let me just show you this. This is even larger initial momentum, and you can see how fast this thing moves. Clearly, if you have a big bang, it looks like a comet's tail by the time it gets to it. This is larger initial momentum. So if you want to have sort of big bang kind of initial conditions, you need to have a really big velocity to start with. And it's going to hit the end of the grid on this small grid really fast, like in a couple of seconds. And the faster the speed, the larger the rise in entanglement entropy as this wave packet evolves.
What's it at scale? I mean, there's a funny structure.
Yeah, this is happening. This starts to happen if the initial velocity is really big for the wave packet. So this is something we're still studying. This is why I didn't show this to you in the main talk, because I want to make sure that this is actually right. Okay, I know it's right for the other cases when the initial velocity is smaller, but for the larger initial velocities, okay. I mean, in a sense, you can sort of see why. I'm not sure about the structure, but you can see why it's going to stretch out even more, much more quickly. Because if you start it off really fast, this universe is going to start expanding rapidly. So the 1 over x squared in the diffusion for phi is going to die very quickly. And whereas the stretching in the scale factor direction is going to continue to increase. And the faster the initial velocity, the faster that stretching occurs. So it sort of makes sense. As about the details of the structure, I'm not sure whether it's really there. Okay. And so since I have some time and I can't find that, I'm just going to run it for you with an entangled state, and then I'll stop. Okay. It's sort of cute to see what happens to that squeeze state. It's sort of, well, you'll see. You can see all the states I've got up here, so I want that one. I won't do too many time steps, I'll just do 20 and, okay, cross your fingers. Oh, that's not the one, sorry. That's not the squeeze state, I picked the wrong one. It's this one. Okay, that's what it looks like. And you'll see that it slowly turns around, it's already squeezed, turns around and it starts marching along. It's not going to go for very, very long because I only put 20 time steps. I think it might be over yet already. Okay, I'll show you later. Anyway, I'll stop there while you watch that.
Plenty of time for questions.
So, have you
you thought about if the states are initially Gaussian and remain close to Gaussian, then you can do a, you can sort of do an approximation, right, where you have sort of the classical evolution plus the sort of evolution of the shape of the Gaussian. Have you thought of, at all about
So the first thing is, so I don't know how to do the analytics properly if I start with a Gaussian with this kind of a time-dependent Schrodinger equation. But I think one check is to see whether it actually does remain Gaussian if I start with a Gaussian, and that requires larger runtimes. So it's certainly looking like it remains somewhat Gaussian from the short runtimes because it's just stretching out like that. But it's hard to know what analytically to do with those shapes as they evolve. Yeah. So, I mean, it's all open.
You didn't start with a Gaussian?
I did start with Gaussians here. But the entanglement entropy did go up, so I think the question was, does it remain Gaussian at late times? And I haven't got to late times yet, so it might stay Gaussian.
Yeah. So, I think the question was they mentioned that you see tension because QFT derivation or the QFT form of space time derivation for quantum gravity makes this assumption.
Yes, it makes that assumption.
Is that you love this quantum state? To which degree is that really a problem? Because, again, to really get QFT, you would have these out completely as a gravity degree of freedom.
So you would have to freeze it out. You'd have to make sure it's not dynamical anymore. But here we're seeing that dynamics going on, at least at early times. But dynamics is not freezing out because it's stretching out in the scale factor direction very rapidly.
So classically,
sorry?
Classically or?
This is quantum mechanically stretching out.
No,
yeah.
What does it mean? I mean, it's quantum field theory of space-time.
Sorry?
Is quantum field theory on curved space-time naive, or should there be another way to make
it? I don't know. I'm raising the question. I'm raising the question. I mean, if quantum gravity is supposed to give everything, it's supposed to give that. And the only derivations we have are using the Wheeler-DeWitt equation and the product ansatz. So I'm only raising the question of the product ansatz here. Yes, on top of that, it requires some sort of Born, and then there are second-order corrections to it beyond this, and it's sort of all in Klaus Kiefer's book and lots of other places.
So the question is, could there be any physical effects that we are missing due to this entanglement?
Yes. Yeah, that's the question I raise, and are they still around when the universe is huge?
But you don't have an answer.
I wish I did.
Speaking of Born-Oppenheimer, isn't it true that in that case, that let's say it's the nuclei degrees of freedom and the electron degrees of freedom? Isn't it true in that case that there's quite a lot of entanglement between the electron and the nuclei?
So I think there it's again the same thing that you assume that you assume this product of this kind at the leading order, the product that I gave here.
But I don't think that is what the Born-Oppenheimer. Oh, depends what you mean by product.
Okay, so I'll show you the product that I'm thinking of. This kind of thing.
That's a pure product. Oh, no.
That's a pure product, and
no, that's not. Q naught is a constant.
So Q naught are just parameters. So this is a Gaussian peaked on some Q naught, and the matter field is on this Q naught background. So Q naught are just parameters in the matter state. That's sort of the.
You have no phi naught. Anyways.
No, I don't have any phi naught here. I just have Q naught because I want the gravity to be peaked. And then this gives.
But anyway, this psi is an arbitrary.
This phi is arbitrary. So this would be a functional of phi, but it would have these parameters in it. But
It's an arbitrary function, is that right?
So this is just the, right now this would have to, so you'd have to plug this into whatever equation you have. You'd have to. For initial conditions, if you just want to do the derivation of QFT on curved spacetime, this would just be arbitrary, yes. This would not be fixed, but this would be fixed. But I thought that this was exactly what Born-Oppen.
But this, if I understand the notation, then this is a real product state.
That is a real product state,
but,
yeah.
But Born-Oppenheimer approximation is not a real product state. There's a dependence. In the second factor, there should be a Q.
There's a Q here too, but it's not a functional of Q because the nuclei is supposed to be fixed. It's just sitting somewhere and it's just dependent on through the parameters. So.
No, I don't think, I mean, suppose you're doing a hydrogen molecule or something like that. There's a nucleon coordinate, which is the relative position between the two, go in the center of mass system.
Okay.
So then there's a coordinate that represents the location of the two nuclei, just a vector.
Okay.
And then there's something that represents the state of the electrons. And that second thing, the electron wave function, is supposed to depend on the location of the first variable.
But this does depend.
It depends on it in a dynamical way.
So I guess
we're at some specific function, it's supposed to be the ground.
So I would say that this depends. It's a functional dependence, but I think you may be thinking of the next order. This is a zeroth order approximation in which we get this.
I think I'm thinking of zeroth.
Okay.
Is Q not actually a constant or not?
It's a set of parameters. They could be functions, but the wave functional, the Q naughts are.
Does it vary with time?
They might vary with time. But they would be fixed classical functions.
Maybe we can fix the details.
Yeah. I should look that up.
But I think it might be an important concept.
Okay.
This making the point, I guess.
That there will be a lot of entanglement.
That you can look at the nuclear electron example and you have the same problem. That's what they're saying. Or the same tension.
It's just the fact that if you fix some system that you consider to be large or classical, basically not affected by the other, and then you solve for, say, the Schrodinger equation in that potential, then, of course, the solution of the Schrodinger equation is going to depend on the parameters.
And that's what this captures.
Yeah, but I think what Raphael is saying, but if instead what you did is you just said, okay, look, I'm going to fix my Q degree of freedom. I'm not going to think about a Q naught. I'm just going to fix my Q degree of freedom to be something, solve the C equation. And then now think about, sort of do that for each Q.
Okay.
It's highly entangled, just because the state of the freedom depends strongly.
Yeah, I mean, it may be. On the other hand, the numerical evolution I'm doing assumes nothing. It's the whole hog, right? So ultimately, I think, Raphael, your question is, what do I want to emerge from that full thing? So that's the question. And what would be suitable to say, okay, I have
a more sophisticated notion of entanglement to whether or not the Born-Oppenheimer of approximation is failing. That's
okay.
In effect what I'm saying.
So here I pull this out basically because that's what people do with the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And they say this is the leading order. But I think from the full evolution, I mean, if you could evolve for a long time, then you have to say, okay, I've got this wave function. Can I break it up and look at it in some way that resembles the Born-Oppenheimer approximation? But that's sort of for later because I'm not there yet.
So I also have a question about when you see this vast spread in your scale factor, can you really call that semi-classical spacetime at some point? It doesn't look like it.
That's the point I'm making, that it's this, I think, related to your question. Does it stay a Gaussian peaked on some scale factor? And if it's really squeezed and the entanglement entropy is high, well, sure, you can see that big yellow spot in the middle, and maybe it's still a Gaussian, but it's stretched out Gaussian. So maybe you can, maybe you can't. I just don't know yet whether you can do that.
It's a totally different kind. You mentioned other possible time gauges.
Yeah.
The natural one is always unimodular times. Have you looked at that?
No, not.
I kind of think, which is what I was trying to say before, that what you've done here is pure gravity, scalar field plus pure gravity, no dust, but in a proper time gain. And then it looks if you do that, it appears as if there's dust. That's what I was trying to say before. So this may be nothing more than a particular choice. It may be more, neither no more nor less than a particular choice of time of gauge. That's just a comment, but then the other comment is, it would be, in any case, interesting to see if you use geomodular time.
Yeah, I think all this is open. I think there's also people using scalar field time, like in loop quantum cosmology, but there they only have the scale factor evolving with respect to the scalar field that they're calling time, so there's no way that they can even look at this. You'd need more degrees of freedom. You'd need a time and two other degrees of freedom to be able to ask questions like this.
Yeah, minimum amount of time is not a full fixing.
Yeah.
But if you're doing homogeneous cosmology, which is what you've been doing so far.
So far I've been doing that.
It is a full fixing.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think that's interesting. That's why I put up that.
But you need to keep the 2 degrees of freedom.
I need to have 2 degrees of freedom, and this way.
You will keep that.
Okay.
If you have also the dust.
No. You mean unimodular time won't keep that?
So here,
if you only consider E and the scalar field, you have a physical
time
space.
Yeah, that's the point I was also making when you first said that. Because here, so if I look at the canonical theory, there actually the gravity, the ADM variables for gravity, the.
Well, I'm not saying to solve the Wheeler derivative.
No, I'm speaking classically at the moment. So if I were to just fix a gauge. And reduced to cosmology, then I would only have a scalar field and I would not have a scale factor if I did that.
But that's just not, how can that be right? You can leave out the scalar. I mean, Yorma Lobo and I did this actually. You can leave out the scalar field altogether, not put in a scalar field, just a pure gravity, use unimodular time. And you get a Schrodinger equation.
Oh, no, that I believe. But I would say then in that case, it's hard to do the entanglement because you need two quantum degrees of freedom.
Yeah, I'm not saying delete. I'm saying if you leave out the scalar field, you still have the geometrical degree.
Oh, I completely agree with that.
If
yes.
If you have the scalar field, then you'll have the 2 degrees of freedom.
Oh, good. I agree then.
You want. And you can study entanglements.
Yes, exactly.
All these questions.
Yeah, exactly. I think we're agreeing because I think if I come back to this, the reason we're agreeing, I think Bianca, what Raphael is saying is that you simply switch off P phi, you still have a physical Hamiltonian, and then the resulting gauge is what he's calling unimodular gauge, which is okay. Switch off the scalar field, and you get that.
So just to clarify, there's no instability associated with the long sign momentum.
We're not seeing this. We're seeing in terms of the Schrodinger evolution, everything is fine, nothing is blowing up. So there's no potential, it's just that you've got two kinetic terms. One kinetic term is positive, the other is negative, and we're simply evolving wave packets. So that would be a question for the spectrum, which William asked. Is the Hamiltonian bounded below? So there's something I didn't mention about the dust time gauge, which is that this physical Hamiltonian is directly correlated, in fact, directly equal to the dust energy density. So if you impose that the dust energy density is positive, then it implies that this Hamiltonian is positive. Otherwise, you violate energy conditions on the dust. Now, if you don't want to do that, you want to say, I'm going to just not care about that, then yes, there's an issue with this being bounded below, because there's a negative sign in front of the kinetic term. But this is something you have to live with if you're doing a gravity system, because the kinetic part of the Hamiltonian constraint has a net negative sign for all models, and the matter sign has a positive sign. So there's no escaping that, actually.
Any more urgent questions? That's not the case, it's a statement I get for a talk on the life of the space.